I wanted to sing this song to begin today. The song is called Hidden in My Silence. The refrain is from a 13th century Muslim poet, wrote in Urdu from North India. His name is Ghalib. It's one of those poems that I saw. As soon as I saw it, I felt like I had to sing it. There was music inside of the words right away. But I combined it with verses taken from a poem of Rumi, who you know quite well, I'm sure. Hidden in my silence are a thousand orphan longings. Words are darkened lamps on a stranger's silent grave. I will keep the silence. There ain't no way to speak of all the things I've come to understand, the secrets that I've saved. Even if the world is godless and chaotic, show me the anchor, teach me the name. If the sun and moon fails and darkness fills the earth, lead me to the light, burn me in the flame. Cause hidden in my silence are a thousand orphan longings. Words are darkened lamps on a stranger's silent grave. I will keep the silence. There ain't no way to speak of all the things I've come to understand, the secrets that I've saved. If there is hunger, if there is famine, show me the harvest, show me the yield. If life grows bitter, full of snakes and poisons, lead me to the meadow, lead me to the field. Cause hidden in my silence are a thousand orphan longings. Words are darkened lamps on a stranger's silent grave. I will keep the silence. There ain't no way to speak of all the things I've come to understand, the secrets that I've saved. And so whatever happens to the world around me, show me the harvest, lead me to the spring. If I have no mouth and no tongue to utter secrets, lead me to the fountain and let the waters sing. Cause hidden in my silence are a thousand orphan longings. Words are darkened lamps on a stranger's silent grave. I will keep the silence. There ain't no way to speak of all the things I've come to understand, the secrets that I've saved. You're going to have to clap with more enthusiasm than that to convince me. I'm sorry. I have done a lot of concerts in churches, and quite often people don't know whether they should clap in church or not, you know. I was in Malaysia, a little place called Ipoh, and the bishop was there, and it was a miserably hot night, sweltering heat. I was sweating like crazy, and they have these fans, you know, in Singapore and Malaysia that run. It's like they're as, you know, as loud as a diesel truck. And I made them turn the fans off because I couldn't hear myself, you know. So the audience was being very patient in the sweltering heat with, you know, no fans on, and they were being very attentive and just clapping uproariously at these songs. And at the end of the concert, the bishop got up, you know, and he wanted to thank me, Father Cyprian, da, 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 da. And then he turned to the crowd and he said, "But you should not clap in church," he says. And they're all kind of shrinking, you know, and then and he finished and I said, "Oh," I said, "Your Eminence, I've heard that it's your anniversary of ordination. Is it 50 years?" He says, "Yes, it is." And people started clapping uproariously. He says, "Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you." It was okay. I was a little bit of an overachiever. I read into about two chapters of the Samir Salmanovich book a bit, and I'm going to give you some of my own context for this. I got about four different ways I could go, but I thought I would tell you this story. When I first started doing work in interreligious dialogue and interfaith dialogue, I'm not sure ever how to call that field, comparative religion in study wise, but convening interfaith gatherings. In the area I was living, certainly Big Sur, this area, and then when I moved into Santa Cruz, there were so many people, it may seem very obvious to you, who are very steeped, for example, in Hinduism through yoga. So many people steeped in Hindu thought and practice through yoga. And so many people, this was actually my entree into the whole thing, steeped in Buddhist thought, mainly through Zen. Though Vipassana is more and more popular nowadays. So I immersed myself in those two things. First of all, put myself through quite a study of Buddhism to learn the different schools and the differences. And they were marvelous for me in teaching me the mechanics of meditation, the Buddhist tradition especially. And even though I was reading the writings and studying very deeply the writings of Father Bede Griffiths, who himself was steeped in Indian thought, the Hindu aspect of it came a little bit later for me, but then I did immerse myself very deeply in the different traditions of India. First of all, in the Upanishads, and then a little bit less in the Vedas, then the Bhagavad Gita, and then went on to the yoga teacher training. So really quite a lot of the Indian thought. In a sense, when I was living especially in Santa Cruz and started immersing myself in these interfaith gatherings, it wasn't that difficult to do those things, to have dialogue with Hindus and Buddhists, because most of them were Americans who knew yoga and knew Zen, and we had all kinds of things in common. Where it got a little more difficult was a couple years after being on the road, when I started realizing where the real dialogue has got to happen at this point is within the prophetic traditions. And by the prophetic traditions, generally in academia, we mean Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And somehow it's almost easier to dialogue with a Buddhist, with a yogi or a Zen practitioner. The Jews, my Jewish friends, it hasn't been such a difficult thing, though we obviously disagree on some very fundamental things. I have a very fine friend who's a rabbi, and we have no arguments about anything, really. But when you start talking about the dialogue between Christianity and Islam, and particularly the dialogue between Jews and Islam, because it's so tied up with the state of Israel and everything else going on, that's a little more dangerous. It's a little more a matter of life and death. And of course, what's happened just in the past week, we see just how much it is a matter of life and death. And so, where do we start with that? Where do we start with that? One of the reasons we call the Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the prophetic traditions. And this is a very important point. This has been very fundamental in my understanding. Is because we have a different conception of time and history generally than what we call the mystical traditions of Asia. It's not to say that there's no mystical element, obviously, to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. There is. But in the East Asian traditions, and I think I get this more from Houston Smith than anybody, they would tend to be the more mystical, psychological traditions, focus much more on interiority, on the development of the psyche, the levels of consciousness, and at least at first manifestation, a little less on outer issues such as social conditions, social justice, and things like that. This is not to put them down, it's just to say that is not necessarily their main aspect. It's much more about the individual development within. And part of that is because their concept of time is not the same as our concept of time. Ours meaning Western Christianity, and specifically the prophetic traditions. Time would tend to be thought of as something you need to escape, and kind of an illusion. Just goes around and around in circles. That's even why the difference between an incarnation and an avatar is very important. An avatar in Hinduism is God every now and then appearing when people need God, need the Divine One. Whereas for us, the incarnation is one very specific moment in time. Time isn't going around and around in a circle. Time is moving somewhere. And where we believe it's moving, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, is to what we would call the reign of God. So when I was in India and somebody said, "Oh yes, Jesus, we love Jesus. We think he's the 11th avatar of Vishnu." You know, there's all these different avatars, and then there was Krishna, and then there was Hanuman, and then there was Jesus. And they thought I'd be really happy about that. Oh, that's very nice. But that's not what we think Jesus is, the 11th avatar of Vishnu. We think there was a very specific moment in time. Now, this is something obviously the Jews and Muslims don't agree with us about, but they do agree with us about this concept that time is a sacrament, not an accident. Because the idea of memory for a Jew is so important. Most of Jewish worship is based on remembering. And usually going back, obviously, to the covenant with Abraham, but also to this decisive event of the Exodus. How much of Jewish worship goes back, you know, you parted the Red Sea in two, eternal is God's mercy. You led the people through the desert, eternal is God's mercy, remembering this. Now we pick that up in the Catholic tradition, especially in the sacramental traditions in general. In our sacramental life, that the action of God, the grace of God, is just as present in the remembering as it was in the actual event. That's why we can say things like, "This is my body, this is my blood," and believe that there's real presence there. So for the Muslims too, this is very important. This was a decisive moment in what they believed to be the revelation of the Quran through the Prophet, peace be upon him, that there's a movement in time. And time is going somewhere. It's not just a circle to be escaped. You follow this? So, finding this common bond between the children of Abraham is very important. At this point, it's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of life and death. What goes along with that, I'm trying to remember who I really got this from. I may have come up with this myself. I'm going to give a talk at Gethsemane this year. We have the fourth Gethsemane gathering now at the Abbey Our Lady of Gethsemane in Kentucky, where Thomas Merton was. It's his 100th, the centenary of his birth. And the talk that I'm going to give at it is about the nature of the self. Because what goes along with this concept of time and the importance of time is a belief in a real self, a self that doesn't disappear. For the mystical traditions, we talked about this a lot yesterday. For example, one aspect of Hinduism would say the self disappears into God like a drop disappears into the ocean. And the Buddhists would say there's no self at all. There's no self of anything. There's no self of a tree. There's no self of a dog. There's no self of Cyprian. It's just change. But we believe in a self, and somehow that goes along with this idea of we believe in time as a sacrament. And that part of the sacrament of time is for this self to be developed and perfected, and we would say in the Christian tradition, even to be divinized and to become not just part of God, not just in union with God, but to somehow to become God. And that, as Teilhard would say, makes up the full Christ. And it's that belief in both history and the self that leads to the prophetic traditions actually having led the way in things like the sciences, in social justice, in human rights. Houston Smith, you know, who's a great lover of world religions, one of the preeminent teachers of it and one of the pioneers of the field, says if any of that exists in the world, it's because of the prophetic traditions. And it's the thing that the prophetic traditions actually have to offer the mystical traditions of Asia. Again, not to say that it's not there at all, but it's like the yin-yang sign of Taoism. Do you know what this is like? There's a dot in each other half. Well, there's a dot of each in each. And what we're looking for, as Father Bede said, is a marriage of East and West. And if the gift of the Asian spiritual traditions is this interiority, the mechanics of meditation, the spectrum of consciousness, then the gift of the prophetic traditions seems to be this notion of time as a sacrament and self as beloved and abiding in mystical marriage with the divine. And what we're looking for is this marriage. So when we start having our conversations with our Jewish and Muslim brothers and sisters, this is one of the places we can start. All that, what happened, I was on the road for, you know, a good 10 years, and what happened along the way is that the introductions to my songs became longer than the songs. And this is one of those situations where I sing this song for you. And there's a story that goes along with it. I was in Denmark, Copenhagen. And I was brought there by a woman I actually had met in India who was sponsoring interfaith work in India, in South India. And the last thing I did was to go and have a presentation at a Sufi gathering. The many Pakistani Sufis living in Denmark, in Copenhagen. Now remember the first controversy over the cartoons of the Prophet happened in Copenhagen, happened in Denmark. So when that happened, one of these young imam named Navid Baig was called upon by the government to start working in dialogue because the violence that broke out there with so many Muslims who were living in Denmark at the time. And he was actually the the sponsor of this group that I went to sing for and talk to. And this woman who had brought me there from an organization called Dan Mission, the Lutheran Danish Mission Organization, she was planning on me going to Lebanon and Syria to do a series of concerts on dialogue through music. And she said she wanted to add Israel onto that trip too, which actually would have been a very difficult thing, and it wound up not happening because of the complications of trying to get into Israel and Lebanon at the same time because of the passports. That's a whole other complicated story. But at one point, she had this brilliant idea, and she said to Imam Navid Baig, she said, "Why don't you go with us?" And his eyes lit up, and he said, "Oh, yeah." So, you know, it sounds like the beginning of a joke, I guess, when an imam and a monk, you know, go to the Holy Land together. And he wrote me an email later, and he says, "Cyprian, we weren't talking about the Holy Land at first. We're going to go to Lebanon, Syria, and Pakistan." It was something like that. Then he sent me an email. I was in England 2 weeks later. He sent me an email and said, "Why don't we go to Israel, the Holy Land together?" He says, "I want to walk into the eternal city with you." This image of it. And it got me thinking about, and yeah, it was like a little moment of the realized reign of God at that moment, you know. But it got me thinking about Jerusalem. In the monastic tradition, we're taught of these different levels of meaning of Scripture. And to make a long story short, the first is just this, the historical context of it, the literal meaning of a story. And secondly would be something like the moral demand that that story makes on you. And a third level would be like the allegorical or the symbolical meaning of a story. And the fourth would be the mystical meaning, however you want it. Those are the categories I understand the best. Now think of that in terms of Jerusalem. For all of our traditions, Jerusalem has all those meanings. that there is the historical city of Jerusalem, what does it mean to a Jew, obviously? What does it mean to a Christian, this place where Jesus himself was spent time and obviously was crucified and buried? What does it mean for a Muslim? It was the second of the holiest cities, you know, when Muhammad had his great night flight to Jerusalem there, and they have one of their most sacred sites of Islam is there on the old Temple Mound, the Mosque Al-Aqsa, and the Temple of the Dome. What does it mean at a moral level? Well, it really means the city of peace, the kingdom of peace for this. At a moral level, what's the challenge of this place between, within each tradition, then between the traditions? It was, when I did get to Jerusalem, it was one of the tensest places. You could feel tension everywhere, especially going out of the Temple Mound and having my Bible confiscated because you couldn't bring a Bible up on the Temple Mound, and going through the metal detectors because of the violence that's been done on the Temple Mound. And now you have some of the more conservative radical Jews trying to take over in the Temple Mound again, you know, which is going to be a very hot topic to come. What does it mean at a symbolic level, the city of Jerusalem, for the Jew? It's the symbol of, yeah, this is the place where all people and all nations are going to come together and what? And worship the one God. Of course, the symbolism of the temple itself, which has never been rebuilt after the second one was destroyed. What does it mean for the Christian? Well, it's an amazing image. I was told along the way that this little snippet from the book of Revelation, which I'll actually sing as the fourth verse here, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven adorned like a bride. That was the most quoted piece of scripture in the early days of Christianity. Such a powerful image, the church as the new Jerusalem, not necessarily about a place, but the church itself, this body, wherever it is the new Jerusalem, the bride. Jerusalem is the bride. What does it mean symbolically for a Muslim? Well, this is the place of Muhammad's night flight. I don't know if you know the story. It doesn't actually mention Jerusalem, but it says Mosque Al-Aqsa, which translated something like the farthest house. And by tradition, it's that it was Jerusalem. He was carried by a horse there. And then from there, he was carried up to heaven. And he had this mystical vision of the seven layers of heaven. I think Dante was actually influenced by Muhammad's night flight. And he was able to discern the hearts of all people. And we're bumping right in. What does it mean at a mystical level? I'll have to leave that one for you. So I put this song together, and I borrowed the phrase from Brother David Steindl-Rast. He wrote a book some years ago with Philip Kaplow on Christian-Buddhist dialogue, and he called it The Ground We Share. And I was thinking of this word ground in all of its various levels of meaning. You see how this song is going to be like 2 minutes long, and I'm talking for 20 minutes on it. What is the ground? The ground is actually the city of Jerusalem, filled with such tension, such foment. The ground at a moral level, is this ground of justice. How are people going to treat each other fairly, even in this little plot of land where the Palestinians are just trying to have a homeland to themselves, where Christians have been fighting with each other for centuries over who gets to run the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where the Jews are fighting to defend themselves from an attack from their neighbors and their enemies. What does it mean at a moral level, Jerusalem? What does it mean then at a symbolic level, this ground? But then ultimately with this ground we share, and I think this somehow is one of the most important levels and probably the place we should always start. Not at the level of dogma and doctrine. The ground of our humanity. The ground of our humanity. This same Dan mission, this Lutheran, Danish Lutheran organization, mission organization, I was so impressed by them. The biggest work they were doing in evangelization, as far as I was concerned, is they were bringing clean water to villages in Egypt. In the Catholic documents that I read about interreligious dialogue, it always starts with social justice and our common humanity. Sharing our basic needs as human beings. And then maybe moving on to sharing ritual and prayer. And the very last thing it mentions is full-on, literally evangelizing. The last thing. You have to build all of that before you can actually get to spread the good news in words to some extent.
Pope Francis got ruffled a lot of feathers when he referred to proselytizing as pious nonsense. But we can start with the ground we share, and the ground we share is the land we share. It's the common needs of all humanity, and it's our human nature in general. Now let me sing this song for you. I'm going to raise it just a little bit. So the first two verses are from the Psalms of Ascents, the songs that the pilgrims would sing as they trudge up the hill to the holy city on pilgrimage. The third verse is based on Surah 17 of the Quran that tells about the Prophet's night flight to Jerusalem. And the last verse is that verse from the book of Revelation. There's a lot of words in the refrain, but if you get some key as to what they are, want to hum along or sing along with me, you're welcome to. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. How my heart rejoiced when I heard the call, let us go to God's house, let us hasten there. And now our feet are within your walls, in the land of peace and the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. Let my tongue be mute, let my hands fall off, if I place you not over every other care, and God forbid I remember not the land of peace and the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. God's servant carried by the Holy One to the farthest house late at night through the air. He saw the good and the evil done in the land of peace and the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven like a bride prepared. God will dwell in the midst of us, in the land of peace and the ground that we share. Sing with me. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. The land of peace and the ground that we share. The land of peace and the ground that we share.
I do.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Oh, I know, I know. I did take a couple of notes. I wanted to, in a little more theoretical standpoint, as I was reading through the prologue, introduction, and first chapter, I jotted a couple of notes down of I could share with you from my perspective of it. One thing I did mark that I really liked in the introduction, in the prologue, was this quote from Ananda Kumaraswamy, the Sri Lankan philosopher. Listen to this again. The modern Christian, those who think of the world as their parish, are faced with the painful necessity of themselves becoming a citizen of the world. We are invited to participate in a symposium and a convivium, to participate, not to preside at it. For there is another, capital A, another who presides unseen. We're called to participate, not to preside, but as one of many guests. I love that. And having had that, the good fortune of traveling extensively in the world and throughout the country, somehow intuitively I knew that that's the position I had to take. I have my credentials. In a sense, I've got a Rev in front of my name and an OSB CAM after it, you know. So I'm a professed monk of a established congregation, and I'm ordained priest in the Catholic Church. I didn't need to do any more with that than that. And then I could just sit down at the table and have a conversation. One of the places that really struck me the most was in Boulder, Colorado, there's a little center called Boulder Integral Life. These are people who used to work with Ken Wilber. And then they started their own little center in Boulder. And I was doing this with Brother David Steinelrost. This had to be, again, about 4 or 5 years into my time out. And what I thought was going on, what I still think is going on, is there's these marvelous conversations about evolution of consciousness going on outside of the church. And I would say probably 3/4 of the people are post-Christians who are doing this. So it may not be necessarily completely outside of the church. It's an extension of the church. But a lot of so-called, recovering Catholics and things like that. But having marvelous conversations, and when I use the word pagan, I actually use it affectionately. Because our friends up at Esalen, who are 11 miles north of us, they call themselves the pagan monastery, And so I really do, I use it affectionately. And the third good of our own congregation's charism is called the Evangelium Paganorum, which is the evangelization of pagans. And I love to talk about that. It's so politically incorrect to say something like that in this day and age, except when you go to Esalen. They just love it, I actually also use that when I visit my Jesuit friends. I tell them I'm engaging in the third. So we were part of this little symposium they were doing at Boulder Integral, and for them actually to invite a Christian speaker to be a major part of it was really kind of something. It was pretty good. And I worked very hard on my presentation, about 2 sessions I did, trying to re-articulate Christianity from within the language I had read from Ken Wilber and from these other traditions. And it was a marvelous event for me because, thanks be to God, it actually really succeeded. And by the end of it, we had a marvelous conversation. I was able to find a way to express things about Christianity that they didn't necessarily agree with, but they at least understood them from their language. So, the whole point of that was, I didn't feel like Christianity actually was welcome at their table. And I wanted a place at that table, but I didn't want a place at that table presiding over it. I wanted a place at that table being part of the conversation, because I actually recognized that they were doing something really good. I thought that Ken Wilber's language was so helpful to me in re-articulating the stages of spiritual growth, for instance. So I was thrilled at the end of those couple of days. In fact, that's exactly where we need to be. there are great conversations going on. And I have some friends who are of a little more evangelical persuasion, a little more traditional, more conservative than I within Catholicism even. And this one kid who had gotten his degree from the University of Dallas, and not stridently polemical about conservative traditional things. He's just very much of that John Paul II generation. It's what he grew up with. Very devotional, great commitment, devotion to Our Lady, to the Blessed Sacrament, and great fans of John Paul II and on with Pope Benedict. But he also did a little bit of yoga with one of the monks that he knew at the University of Dallas, and somehow that little thing has opened his mind to something else. And he was interested in doing something in medicine. And I said a line to him, just kind of kiddingly. I knew his mother-in-law quite well. I said, boy, I said, the pagans are so far ahead of us in natural health. He said, what do you mean? I said, why aren't we doing Chinese herbal medicine? Why aren't we doing chiropractic? Why aren't we doing all these great things? Because that's what the monks used to do in their pharmacies, and the monks and the nuns, yeah. Our own monastery at Camaldoli, the pharmacia, antica pharmacia, the great liqueurs that come out of the monasteries were actually medicines at first. At first, yeah. And he said, and it just somehow that little line got them, and he brought it back to me several times. He says, you're so right. Again, I'm using the word pagan very affectionately. Why are the pagans so far ahead of us on that? And the other place where I feel it's just kind of going into the atheism part of it there. Why are the pagans so far ahead of us on environmental issues? It's a crime that cries to high heaven. And our friends at Esalen, brilliant on sustainability, brilliant on permaculture, brilliant organic farm, brilliant on the studies they're doing, the symposia that they're holding there about how to live more gently on the planet. As with our Buddhist friends down in Carmel Valley, who are totally solar power, even stopped using their kerosene lamps so they wouldn't be, they would have an absolute zero carbon footprint. Our friends up at Mount Madonna in Watsonville, brilliant with their solar power and their use of composting toilets and things like that. Most Christian, Catholic retreat centers, parishes, haven't got a clue about this stuff. Not a clue. It doesn't even enter into the conversation. I tease about this, but I'm dead serious. I'm having a hard time getting our monks to recycle their plastic milk bottles. That's ground level, entry level. Why are the pagans so far ahead of us? Why haven't we figured out that this is a Christian value in our stewardship over the earth? So the pagans are making me a better Christian. Yeah. This is what we're talking about in this book, I think. I know you want me to, but we did start late, so. Yeah. I'm just getting warmed up here. So. Yeah, pagans. Yes, go back to the pagans. And again, using that word very affectionately. Yeah. Oh, from Kumaraswamy's quote. To realize that we're a citizen of the world means that there's a great conversation going on in the world that we're part of. We're not presiding over it. If we're presiding over it, we're presiding over it as the servants. We're presiding over it as the head waiters, the head waitresses. And this is some of the mentality I'm even trying to inculcate also at our monastery, at our hermitage. The days of when people would come to the monastery so the guru could dish out all the spiritual wisdom, they're gone. We have our gift to offer, and our gift is spirituality, meditation, prayer, lectio, liturgy. But there's so much we don't know about that our friends bring to us. And I'm much more comfortable when we monks have a place at the table rather than to think that we're either hovering above the table about 6 feet high on a lotus petal, or else we're not there in the conversation at all. In our world, this is not an option now. And one of the reasons it made me think of that, also from this last song, I remember thinking of two particular political personalities who were on the news saying very ignorant things about Islam because they did not know the tradition. They didn't know the tradition. And the problem with that is that when somebody important says something like that on television, somebody in Pakistan dies for it. When somebody important in America says something totally wrong about Judaism and Islam or their religions or their state, somebody in Palestine loses their house over it. So the moral obligation to know what we're talking about when we open our mouth is very, very important at this point. Moral obligation. I want to, I'll give you this much, and if it's a good time for a break, then it's a good time for a break. Where I find myself relying more and more is on a theology of the word, and I mean word with a capital W. Word as in the concept that we get from the Greek tradition, logos, which means something like the intelligence principle, the intentionality of the cosmos, the directionality of evolution, means all those things. And there have been very strong arguments made from a philosophical point of view of this is actually what Taoism is trying to convey as well. So the logos of the Greeks and the Tao of the Chinese are similar, if not equal, concepts. There's a beautiful book called Christ the Eternal Tao, written by an Eastern Orthodox monk, that makes a very convincing argument about this. So one translation of the Gospel of John into Chinese would be, in the beginning was the Tao, and the Tao was with God, and the Tao was God, and the Tao was made flesh and dwelt among us, and that's Jesus, that the Tao made flesh. So this concept of logos, Tao, word, I start there. And how I was taught was this. Wherever there is beauty, truth or goodness, what the philosophers call the transcendentals, wherever there is that, that is already a manifestation of the word. Saint Justin Martyr had this concept of semina verbi, the seeds of the word. He's mainly at this point in his time talking about the Greek philosophers. Mind you, the Greek philosophers are pagans. Okay, and worshipping false idols. But he says, we can use Greek philosophy because seeds of the word were scattered everywhere and are sprouting up in the truth of Greek philosophy. So we could adopt a pagan philosophy because there's truth in there, and that can be our vehicle to transmit Christianity. Well, I don't think it's dangerous at all to spread that out into what the philosophers call the transcendentals of beauty, truth, and goodness. Wherever I see something beautiful, that's already a manifestation of the Word, who is with God, who is God, and who was made flesh in Jesus. Wherever there's goodness, that's already a manifestation of the Word that was with God, that was God, that was made fully flesh in Jesus, the fullness of which is born in Jesus. So wherever I see beauty, truth, or goodness, anywhere, that's not just pre-Christian. This is the phrase of Jacques Dupuy, a great Jesuit scholar of interreligious dialogue. It's not just pre-Christian, it's pro-Christian. It's pointing to the Christ. Now, we're perhaps, what's the word for it? Parochial enough to think, to believe that the fullness of this is made flesh in Jesus, which our brothers and sisters in other traditions won't believe, but we can still hold on to that, that the fullness of divinity dwelt in Jesus. But the main point there is, if there's a truth conveyed in a scientific experiment, that's a manifestation of the Word. If there's social justice being done by people who don't believe in God at all, that's a manifestation of the Word. But specifically what we're talking about here, and this is what's echoed in a sense in the document Nostra Aetate from the Second Vatican Council, wherever there's something good, true, and beautiful in another tradition, in their sacred texts, in what they believe and in their practices and their way of life, we not only acknowledge it, we uphold it and we encourage it and are encouraged to be in dialogue with that. So that gives me lots of room to breathe. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for those seeds of the Word that are sprouting up all over the place. And one last little point about this that I find also very exciting is quite often, this is a notion I get from Raimundo Panikkar, not that the fullness of truth doesn't subsist in the revelation, in the Christian revelation, but that perhaps we haven't uncovered it yet. And there may be aspects of that truth that another tradition has uncovered that they're going to actually teach us something about our own tradition. Do you follow what I'm saying? Like, I did not have a good sense of Christian anthropology until I studied yoga. And suddenly I realized, oh, this is what the Gospels are trying to say, that we hadn't caught yet. We didn't get it through Greek philosophy, because Greek philosophy told me that my body's a tomb for my soul, whereas yoga taught me that the body's the means of salvation, the tool, and then to find a new way to express the resurrection and the ascension and the transfiguration. You see what I'm saying? And Panikkar talks about the three persons of the Trinity this way. It could be that the apophatic mystical traditions like Taoism or Zen Buddhism, for instance, are teaching us something about the silent, mysterious aspect of the first person of the Trinity that we don't uncover very often in normal popular religiosity of Christianity. It could be a tradition such as the Bhakti tradition of India or the devotional, beautiful devotional marriage poems of somebody like Rumi are teaching me something about my devotion to Jesus in ways I would never have expressed it otherwise. When I read some of the beautiful Bhakti poetry of South India, when I read some of the poetry of Hafiz or Rabia or folks like that, I'm learning to express my love, my devotion for Jesus in a way I never would have done it before. When I heard this group called Aradhana, they sing songs from India to Jesus. I rarely say this to another musician. I went up to them and I said, "You ministered to me." Like I saw a new face of Jesus I hadn't seen before. In terms of the spirit, the one aspect of it that I get this from Panikkar, what I've learned from other traditions, for example, the Chinese notion of qi or the Indian notion of kundalini, and even to some extent the Greek notion of eros, which I think is really untapped in our tradition, learn something about the dynamism and the power of the spirit. We tend to think of the spirit either as a static element or the spirit that intervenes from above. And we don't have a great notion of the spirit as dynamis, as Luke says in his gospel. Spirit as power that's impelling us forward. That God is not just an interventionist, but God is behind the power of evolution and behind the power of human growth. Now, I might have learned that more from Qi and Kundalini, but I also might have learned something also about the pervading nature of the spirit from my Native American brothers and sisters. That is not... that doesn't go against Catholic teaching at all. But I had never uncovered that in third grade CCD class. Maybe I'll sing one more song and then we'll take a little break. Can we do that? This is a song actually taken from the Dhammapada, which is an early text of Buddhism. The Dhamma is like the word Dharma in Sanskrit, means the teaching or the way. And Pada is a book, the book of the way, probably written in Pali, so an early kind of monastic book. There is no sorrow like separation. There is no fire worse than greed. But there is no joy
There is no joy like freedom. There is no sickness like sickness of heart. There is no fire worse than hate. There is no joy, there is no joy, there is no joy like freedom. Look at the birds of the air. Learn from the flower of the field. Look deep within and be still. And know. Greater than anything you could possess are health and contentment and trust. And there is no joy, there is no joy, there is no joy like freedom. Freed from attachments and worry and fear, the sweetness of living the way. There is no joy, there is no joy, there is no joy like freedom. Look at the birds of the air. Learn from the flower of the field. Look deep within and be still. And know. Thank you.